Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Joe Shaw, executive editor of the Express News Group. With me is my co-host, Bill Sutton, who is the managing editor of the Express News Group. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, Joe. Hey, everybody.
And our panel today, three distinguished colleagues from the East End. We have David Rattray, who is the editor of the East Hampton Star. Good morning, David.
Hey, Joe. Everybody, how are you?
Grant Parpin, who is the content director up at the Times Review Media Group in Riverhead and on the North Fork. Hey, Grant.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me. Good to see
you,
everyone.
Good to see you again. And we have Kaylin Riley. She's a freelance journalist, veteran freelance journalist on the East End. She's written for a lot of the East End publications, and she's got reporting this week about the return to high-risk scholastic sports throughout Suffolk County. Good morning, Kaylin.
Hi, everyone.
So we'll start with that. I think that's a topic that touches on all of our publications and all of our readers care about it. Suffolk County this week said that it was okay to start going back to some of the more high-risk sports that involve a little more contact. They had allowed track and some other sports that are outside and didn't involve quite the contact levels. But now Suffolk County's actually given the go-ahead to schools to start playing again in February. Correct, Kaylin?
Yes, that is right. Governor Andrew Cuomo, people had been waiting for a while to hear from him how he was going to rule on this. And ultimately what he did was decided to leave it up to individual counties and their departments of health. And last week, County Executive Steve Ballone decided that he gave it the thumbs up. And so it was basically a go, although obviously each school district, it's up to their discretion. And so on Monday night's Board of Ed meeting in Sag Harbor, Superintendent Jeff Nichols made the recommendation against letting the school run high-risk sports. Now, Pearson High School has its own boys and girls basketball teams. They do not have a wrestling team, but they have a few kids who compete on East Hampton's team as part of its shared sports program. So he said no, and the board pretty much agreed with him. Obviously, athletic director Eric Bramoff was really hoping it would turn out differently, but he accepted Jeff's decision.
And Pearson's the only school that isn't going to play basketball, right?
They are the only, as of now, I believe. I have to double check, but I believe the Ross School might also not be doing basketball. But aside from that, no, there are no other public schools in Suffolk County that are not running basketball seasons.
And that's a fairly big deal in Pearson, right? I mean, basketball is a big program in Pearson.
It is. And I can tell you that personally, as a graduate of Pearson High School, I graduated from there in the 90s, and games against Bridgehampton were always packed to the gills. Obviously, there's not going to be spectators at these games this year anyway. But yeah, there's a real fine basketball tradition. And both teams have been good the past couple of years. So it was a real crushing blow to those kids, and it's a tough decision all around. But Mr. Nichols, I spoke with him the other day, and he's firm in that decision, and it doesn't look like it's going to change.
Grant, you came out of sports and have stayed in contact with the local sports scene. Can you give us your reaction to all this? What's some context to this? There's a lot of constituencies involved, right? You've got the athletic programs, you've got the kids, you've got the parents, you've got other students who don't play sports who might be worried about the safety of all this. How do you parse all this?
Yeah, and you also have schools doing testing. You know, they were talking about that the other night at the Southold Board of Education meeting on Wednesday, that schools are going to actually be testing these kids. That's a first for them. I know in Riverhead, there was some testing being done when they were in the yellow zone designation in Hampton Bays as well. But now for student athletes, they're going to get tested once a week. What happens in those other 6 days? Who knows? Hopefully, everybody's following the rules and staying, trying their best to not get infected. But you have once a week, they're going to be doing testing with all these kids, which is very unusual position for these schools to be in. So that's really interesting. You know, one thing that I don't know about you guys, but as an editor, don't you kind of hate that term high risk sports? Sound like they have like school skydiving teams at these schools or something.
Rollerball.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a kind of tricky, it's a tricky situation for these schools and for these, you know, at Southold, they were talking about how they're going to be streaming the basketball games for the first time because they've never, they're not going to have fans there and people are going to want to see it. Your parents aren't going to be able to see their kids play.
When they say high risk, we're talking about basketball, wrestling. Are there other sports involved that they consider high risk?
Football and
lacrosse.
And cheerleading.
Yeah, for the winter right now, the ones that are going to start next week are wrestling, basketball, and cheerleading.
Mm-hmm. And is there a plan for football in the spring or no? Are they going to just push that off to the fall again?
So no,
I think they're running starting on March 1st. I believe an abbreviated fall sports season, and then they'll do the spring sports at the end of the year. But I don't know if they're running football or not.
Yeah, so it seems like there's an effort to try and get these kids onto the field. I mean, this means a lot to the kids, especially if you're a senior. I mean, this is your last chance to, if you're a senior football player, if you're a senior basketball player, this is your last chance to play for schools. Yeah.
Yeah, Joe Voss, the East Hampton athletic director, jumped in, you know, pretty quickly with a firm yes to resume these competitive sports here. The timing is interesting because it really Steve Ballone's decision to allow districts to make these decisions came almost at the same moment the Centers for Disease Control released a big study about getting kids back into in-person learning or maintaining in-person learning. And they basically, the upshot of it was based on a lot of studies, a meta study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, is that if you're going to do in-person learning, something has to give. And the two things they talk about giving are indoor dining and sports, indoor sports practice and games. And you know, the JAMA cites a number of examples where indoor sports become a nexus for super spreader events among players, coaches, and then family members. So it's kind of an interesting moment where local officials are going in 180 degrees, the opposite direction of federal officials. And still, I think with this virus, nobody really knows what end is up. I think we're still kind of feeling as we go along.
Has anybody had a chance to gauge the reaction to this move from kids or parents or, you know, school officials seem a little divided? Kaylin, have you had a chance to talk with anyone?
Yes. So yesterday I spoke at length on the phone with Hudson Brindle. He is a senior at Pearson High School. He's an interesting case because he's a three sport athlete and every sport he plays is classified as high risk. So he played football last year as part of the shared sports program with Southampton. Pearson used to share with East Hampton, and last year they shared with Southampton. He plays boys lacrosse, and in the last few years, boys lacrosse out here has had a combined South 14 with Pearson. I think Ross is included as well, East Hampton and Southampton. And then, of course, he plays basketball. He's going to Tufts University next year. He's a really smart, well-spoken kid. But this is his senior year, and he's facing the very real possibility that he won't get to play a single sport. He has played three sports, he said, since he was a child in all the PAL leagues, and he's captain of the basketball team. And they're good. They were going to have a really good season this year. And so he actually started the day after the school board and Jeff made the decision not to allow the team to play, he started a petition on change.org, and it has more than 500 signatures at the moment. And it's interesting because when I spoke to Jeff yesterday, I was actually speaking to him about the fact that they currently have 100 students quarantined in Pearson Middle High School. He was saying he's not upset at all that these kids started the petition. He spoke with them. He said, you know, this is within their right. It's almost like a little mini civics lesson that they are allowed to do something like this. And Hudson, you know, had nothing bad to say about Mr. Nichols. Not that he's going to say that in a public forum. to a reporter, but you know, there seems to be some respect on both sides, and it's such a tough call. Like, you, everything that Mr. Nichols says makes sense. And then you listen to these kids. I mean, I played field hockey in high school. If someone told me I couldn't play my senior season of field hockey, I probably would have not stopped crying for months.
Yeah. Granted, if you have,
if Facebook is any indication, and I never used Facebook as an indication, but so we did post the story about the Sag Harbor School Board saying that they weren't going to play sports on the Sag Harbor Express Facebook page. And the public was really seemed very supportive, almost militantly supportive of that decision that safety should come first. And you know, I'm so on the fence, you know, about this thing. I understand, you know, the reaction of the kids, and the kids want to play and you want to get back to normal and all that. But, you know, the term high risk, when you're talking about coronavirus, there's going to be some risk there. I know that there's not a lot of transmission in schools, but you're talking about putting kids on the court or on the wrestling match where they're going to be, you know, there's going to be contact. They're sweating on each other. They're running around, they're breathing on each other. There's not going to be masks. It's my understanding. They're not going to be wearing masks. And, you know, I was originally thinking back, well, you know, back in the summer, everybody was saying, no, you can't put kids back in school. You know, it's going to be too much of a risk. And we said, let's take a chance and let's do that. And it was successful. And it worked out. But what worked out and what was successful in schools was kids and teachers and staff taking those precautions and social distancing and wearing masks and all of that, all those things that you're not going to see on the basketball court. So it's a very tough thing.
And yeah, Southhold, as a student representative on the board, and when it was his time to speak, he said, you know, thank you for bringing sports back. I'm on the bowling team. I finally, after almost a year, I have something to do.
Yeah.
I think that's what a lot of the kids are looking at. And I think parents, too. I mean, I know, Caitlin, you have young children like me, and I have a son who's in first grade, a daughter who's in pre-K. And my son's going to 4 days a week from 2 days a week starting next week. And good, get that kid out of the house, you know. Like, I mean, I know we're not supposed to have COVID fatigue, and we're supposed to preach responsibility in the media. I think that's an important responsibility that we have, that we need to kind of set the record straight and say people need to take this seriously. But at the same time, you know, I think it's at this point where you really start to worry about these kids. I mean, how are they spending this time? I mean, my kids are just they're watching TV, they're playing video games, because I have to work, you know. I mean, how much can I do? I'm trying to get them to do the right thing, but that's not always the case. And then you talk about these
solidarity, Grant. Solidarity. Yeah.
I mean, you talk about these older kids that, you know, these athletes that they're used to a certain amount of physical exercise, and when they're not getting that, what does that do to their mental health? I think this is something, a period of time that I think people are going to study for a really long time, the effects that this had on people. And I think this is a population. There's 21,500 student athletes in Suffolk County.
Yeah. And just to clarify real quick, Grant, the players won't be wearing masks while they're playing, but they will be wearing them while they're on the sidelines. Correct. Is that the plan?
Yeah. I know in winter track, they are wearing masks right now, which they're probably grateful of, because they're doing winter track right now. It's like 16 degrees outside. Yeah. But they are doing it in some. I think in the bulk of the sports, they're not.
So how's that end of the season working out? And they started the, I'm going to do air quotes, low risk sports. They started that about a month ago, right, Caitlin, with the track and some other sports. Those seem to be going okay, right? Except it's so cold, they're canceling the meets, right?
Like on a day like if there was a track meet scheduled for today, it would be canceled, because it's like gale force winds and in the teens. So there's that. And they have some different guidelines with the masks. With, I think when you're running a distance event in the beginning and in the end, you have to have the mask up. But when you're in the middle of the race and there's some separation, you're allowed to pull it down for a period of time. Because it's something that's restricting your breathing to a certain degree.
Sure.
But the interesting thing in talking to Hudson was when he said, you know, these kids are so desperate to play. He was saying, you know, I think we should wear masks when we play basketball games, which was interesting to hear him say. He also mentioned he would be willing to switch from what he does now, which is his hybrid schedule, and go all virtual, stay at home just so he could play. And another thing we should mention is I also spoke with Ethan Mitchell yesterday, who's the varsity head coach of the East Hampton wrestling team. And they are not running a season. So East Hampton's running boys and girls basketball, but not wrestling. They're going to have an intramural season. And that's another interesting thing because they're both classified as high risk, but there you might see some other schools making some sort of distinction between the risk of basketball and wrestling, which to me seems like a little bit of a hair splitting kind of situation to deem one of those safe and not the other.
And none of these would include live crowds watching the events, right? Correct? They would be restricted, right? David, I think you touched on it, and I think it's a fascinating aspect of this. It fits into a larger context about the point Grant made about just getting kids back to school safely and the CDC saying that we should be working towards doing that. That's the bigger context here, isn't it?
Well, that's right. The CDC says that the benefits of in-person school attendance are well known. And, you know, the list is long, from mental health to free meals to all sorts of things, to special needs on the educational side. And what the CDC is saying is it is not worth jeopardizing the in-person instruction for sports for a limited number of students, and also the risk for the students, the student athletes' families, is unacceptable. But what's fascinating about this is something that I think about a lot: is the pandemic, the management of the pandemic is so diffuse. So, you know, you've got the CDC saying something that's supported by medical science, you know, signed on to by really the top people in the game. You know, that's sort of passed and filtered down through the state and then through, you know, Suffolk County Legislature. And we've talked before about how big Suffolk is. And then it's handed out to school boards, which are epidemiologically probably not the most well-versed. So there's a peculiar kind of lack of deference to scientific authority all the way, you know, sort of from the school board level all the way up. If the CDC was making the decisions, it would be very much in favor of in-person school attendance and limiting any risk factors that could threaten that because the benefits are known. But structure of American government, you know, we have, as de Tocqueville said, these little tiny organizations making decisions for themselves, whether that's going to result in increased mortality, lost productivity for people who are sick. You know, what it is clearly going to do is have an effect on the poorer communities, where a student athlete who gets exposed to the virus, maybe asymptomatically, is going to bring it home, is going to infect other people in the household, multiple generations, sometimes other families are in the household. So there's, again, there's this sort of social justice blindness to this push to get student athletes back into competition. And I really think that Ballone and the Suffolk County Health Department, you know, it will probably regret having made this decision, you know, and punting it out to a bunch of people with zero expertise. It's quite a weird moment, I think. I think the cart is way before the horse on this. And then, you know, it's not me saying this. This is, you know, the CDC and the Journal of American Medical Association. So it's a very strange moment, really.
Sometimes.
And the decisions that are made at the school level are going to have an impact on the larger community as well. So
that's right. Yeah, it could kill grandma. It just doesn't. Yeah, that's what CDC says. Don't kill grandma.
Huh. I totally agree with you, David. And here's what I think makes this so hard. That is all true. And then what's also true is that for that same group of kids, sometimes participating in sports is the most important for that group of kids, too. And that's why it's a real, real conundrum, because you definitely have kids who everything you said is true. And then the sports is even more crucial for them and their life and their mental health than maybe some other kids, whether it's a kid that doesn't have a good support group at home and their coach is their lifeline or their team. So that's why it's just such an incredibly, incredibly difficult decision to make.
I've said it before, but I think it bears repeating. I think the school districts have really had a heavy lift through this, but I think have done a pretty remarkable job across the board of managing all of the various constituencies and all of the concerns that we're talking about, and have had pretty good success in being at least reflexive and responding to situations. I think they deserve a tip of the hat. It's an unworkable situation. There's no good, as we've said in the past, it's a choice for very bad options, and you try and take the least bad option, and people are going to get sick. Grant, I can't let it pass without saying you are recovering from COVID-19, correct? How are you feeling?
Yeah. Is this a HIPAA violation that you put that out in the airwaves?
But, we'll settle out of court.
You ever get that complaint?
Covered.
You ever get that complaint from readers? That's a HIPAA violation. It's like, I'm not your doctor.
Yeah. All the time.
But, I should have asked permission first, I guess. But I hope you're doing well.
I'm joking. Yeah, we're doing well. And that was a situation where we really didn't, we've been pretty good. We haven't been going out doing much. We're laying really low. And we had three family members over for Christmas Eve. And every single person at my Christmas Eve dinner table got it. Mm-hmm. And then the real big mistake that I made was was working on a project that brought me down to North Carolina, where my parents are half the year and my brother is. And so I, said to my mom, we had been separating from them. I said, what do you think? We'll get tested right before we go. Went down there. Next thing you know, my mom, speaking of getting grandma sick, my mom, my dad, luckily everybody had really mild cases and we're all doing well. My mom was like, she is like, the poster child for pre-existing conditions. No offense, mom, if you're listening, she's a wonderful woman, but she's had her share of health issues. And she was our big concern. And I remember driving back up to New York, just like I had tears coming down my face at times while I'm driving, just thinking about that. I just killed my mom.
Wow.
And it never got worse than a mild cold for her.
Oh, thank goodness. This is at the forefront of everybody's minds. There's no question. We could do entire shows just about COVID and vaccines and all of that. There's no question.
But think about how bad a kid's going to feel if their grandma gets infected because they were wrestling. I mean, it is scary. It is very scary. I think with everything with COVID, you kind of have to see all sides on it. It's really hard to be super judgmental about every single thing, because every decision that's made is tough with this.
And David, to your point, it's now on school boards to weigh all of that and be Solomon and try and come up with the right solutions here.
Yeah, it is fascinating that, even the towns don't really have health departments, and certainly school districts really don't. If they have a school nurse and they've brought on people to manage sort of the classroom COVID response and preparation, which, of course, as you pointed out, Joe, has been completely amazing. There's been almost next to no cases of in-school transmission locally and even nationally. It's been an extraordinary success. And you remember at the outset, teachers were afraid to go back to the classroom. Some of them were calling in sick. Some of them were, deeply opposed to these plans, and understandably so, because they didn't know. But the districts, to that extent, by maintaining mask wearing, social distancing, scheduling so that the halls aren't overcrowded, letting certain kids come half the day, playing around with different schedules, AB groups, things like that, really have been exemplary. And so that's why you'll hear something like Governor Cuomo say, it's not really community spread anymore. It's living room spread. It's what's happening in the home. It's what someone's bringing home. Schools really have been kind of the rock stars in all of this. I think that this sports thing is interesting. I don't know where it'll go, but it certainly is inconsistent with what the schools did previously. It's not the same.
Exactly.
In fact, it does all of the things that the COVID preparation tried to avoid. We'll see.
Another thing to point out about sports, and in the board meeting, board member Sandy Kuhl, who's very active and involved in sports, she's very active in Hampton's Collegiate Baseball. She agreed with Jeff, even though you could see like visibly on her face that it pained her to do so because she's such a lover of sports. He pointed out, and Hudson said this to me too, and I know that this is true, kids are playing sports. They are playing in travel leagues and they are like a Wild West. Sports in Suffolk County, high school sports have a governing body. There's a whole group of people whose job it is to create rules and standards. And they put an enormous amount of work into trying to do everything they could to keep these sports safe. They're making the kids take this, you know, honor system kind of pledge. They have all these protocols in place. There is no governing body for travel sports, generally speaking. And these kids, especially the ones that are serious about the sports they play and want to play in college, and even little kids, like kids the age of my children, they are all playing in travel sports. And I do think, you know, they're trying to do things safely too. But what one privately owned travel sports company is doing is not the same as the one that's coming to visit for a game that weekend. And so that's happening as well. And I think that makes it kind of frustrating to some of the kids, because they're like, well, I can play my travel team, but why can't I play on my high school?
Yeah, let the kids run health policy for the community.
At least it'll add some structure to it, no question.
At this point, though, it's like there's no consistency from the top about what's allowed and what's not allowed.
That's
and
right.
I guess there's no way you can regulate these travel leagues because they're private entities. But and it's also a privilege thing, too. Like, you have to pay to play travel sports. So yeah, you might have a kid who, again, their lifeline might be their varsity team or their coach, and their parents don't have the money to pay for them. Some of these travel leagues, thousands of dollars it costs to be part of these teams. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
This is Behind the Headlines. I'm Joe Shaw, the executive editor of the Express News Group. With me is my co-host, Bill Sutton, managing editor. And our guests today are David Rattray, the editor of the East Hampton Star, Kaylin Riley, who's a freelance journalist who's written for a lot of us, and Grant Parpin, who is the content director of the Times Media Group. Grant, I want to switch gears and talk about a story you're writing about and have been for a long time. I mean, there's a civil case up your way that dates back to a crash in December of 2014, I believe, that had some news this week.
Yeah, it's the case of John Costello. It actually made regional headlines when he was first arrested, and he was the New York Times did a column about how he was one of his kids went to the prom with the judge's kid, and the judge only gave him $250 cash bail after he killed somebody. You know, it's got this real small town cronyism kind of component to it that's made it a fascinating story for a lot of people. But it's also the person that he killed was a vineyard farmhand, somebody who was from, you know, born in Guatemala, was living here without documentation. And it's make for a really interesting civil case. He pleaded guilty back in 2016, and the judge told him at the time, you know, when you're pleading guilty here in criminal court, you're going to be held liable in civil court. And he was. There was quickly a default judgment on that. But there's a lot of other claims for conscious pain and suffering, claims for lost wages that he has. John Costello, a lot of people, I think, on the East End are familiar with him. He owns Costello Contracting. He's a man of a lot of resources. And he's thrown a lot of his resources at this case to sort of, in my mind, delay the process and avoid having a payment in this, having, you know, having it go to trial or having a settlement. And it's just a really interesting case. A judge ruled last week that to go on, that a lot of these claims, he tried to get a lot of the remaining claims thrown out, said that he hired us Michael Bodden, who I think a lot of people are familiar with, was the New York City medical examiner and testified in the O.J. Simpson trial and a lot of other high profile cases. He reviewed the autopsy and prepared a report that said there's no way this guy could have suffered conscious pain and suffering. He had to have immediately been unconscious. But the driver of the vehicle the guy was in said, you know, he said to me he was in pain. He asked me to call his family in Guatemala. I spoke to some lawyers about it who are familiar with the case, who said it's just one of the more interesting civil cases they've seen. It's dragged on for years, really not much movement, but a lot of deposing people a second time, just a lot of things where a guy who's, you know, now in his late 70s, kind of kicking the can down the road a bit. but it didn't really work out in his favor. And it seems like it'll probably be up for a trial later this year if they can't reach a settlement. And he's probably looking at paying a couple million dollars.
David, I'm intrigued by this because of the two-phase nature of our justice system when it comes to some crimes and when it comes to some defendants. I think, Grant, you mentioned this is a wealthy man. There's at least been some intimation that he got off a little bit easy in the criminal phase of this. But the civil phase is really where the penalty comes. I find it fascinating that that's the way our justice system seems to work now, that there's a different kind of justice that's playing out for certain defendants.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the ability to hire aggressive counsel really is what it comes down to. You know, and I think that also plays into when the district attorneys, assistant ADAs decide to take a case is they don't want to have a losing record. And they do recognize, I think, that certain defendants are going to be more difficult to convict. But yeah, the quality of being able to spend $1 million on on litigation is really determinative, because so many things do go to settlement. In the case of John Costello, the longer you can kind of draw it out, probably he thinks the lower the settlement's going to be. East Hampton Town, I think, is about, speaking of which, to sort of get the litigation hammer brought down on it by the group in Wainscott who are opposed to the wind farm cable. The East Hampton Town finally inked a deal with the developer, which is called Orsted Eversource, for a power cable to run under the beach in Wainscott to join into the Long Island electricity grid. And it's very funny. The New York Post actually grabbed it, but the New York Post figured out that the group opposing the cable had $1 million in the bank, of which they've spent about $250,000 or $300,000. The implication being the remainder is going to be for high-priced lawyers to make the town of East Hampton's life difficult and try and get this decision about the cable returned. I guess, it's really a war of attrition, and whoever brings the more ammunition to the siege is likely to prevail in the long term.
And Bill, we just made that point this week. This past week, about the case involving the Discovery Land proposal in East Quogue. And our editorial conclusion was that the one with the biggest checkbook and the most patience really can wait these things out and win in some cases. I think this is all sort of a theme here, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's the ability to play the long game, I guess. And, in the case of Discovery Land, just stretch it out and stretch it out and stretch it out until there was, to use a term we're banding around lately, there was an exhaustion on the part of community members opposed to it and all that. And, it gets to a point where it's like, well, they're just going to get it done anyway. So whatever. And they step back. I think that case will still, that development is still going to be determined what's going to happen with that. There are a couple cases still to be litigated, but they certainly have the power and the money to sit back. And it sounds like in these other cases, it's the same thing. It's fascinated by this, Grant story criminally, this guy who admitted that he was intoxicated and got in the car anyway and hit this other guy. And there's no jail time for that. And granted a first offense or whatever, but that's just so odd to me.
Grant, what's next in that case?
Look forward to. I got to give a shout out to my mom again. She did the same thing, instituted the weekly call with all the family members, and it mm-hmm. was really so positive. Now I hear that someone's trying to connect with you, Dr. Banks. So
yeah,
I'm gonna let you go. Or I'll, know what? Maybe I'll just play On the Road by Stefan Grossman. I'll let it play underneath us a little bit here. We've got 5 minutes before NPR News, so I'm going to give mm-hmm. them one more track. As we lead in, I'm going to play Cake's guitar from the Prolonging the Magic record. We went from 2018, we hopped back to 1988, and we'll go to 98. We're doing a little shuffle here as we lead into NPR News. But I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming on the show again. And I can never, I'm always excited about the next time that we speak. And I also can't thank you enough for educating the young and the olds, you know, people of every age here on Long Island. What you do is such a special thing.
Well, you know, I always say education is an exchange. It's a recycling business. So as I'm educating, people are also educating me. And I want to thank you and also the listeners who, in fact, listen and perhaps undertake some of the things that we are talking about, and also return that information to myself and other people, because I think that is what education is about. It's an exchange. It's I'm a depositor, but I'm also a depository, and I like to think of it in that way, and talk about how the young people have taught me so much in my lifetime that I don't want to lose track of them, and that's why I want to invest as much as I can in this exchange that we call education.
Beautifully said. The next song is about someone who's thinking about not creating, not continuing this type of exchange. We hope you will do so and go to WLIWFM.org. Dr. Banks, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk soon, yeah?
Support NPR, support WLIW, let's go, don't give up.
And the community, support your brothers and sisters, no matter what color of skin they have, or, you know, however they identify, you know, get it together and keep it together, my friends.
Right back at you. Positive, peaceful, productive, and
passionate.
Passionate. I love passionate. I think I want to adopt that.
On the heart
of I will give you credit for it all the time.
No need. No need. You go on your merry way. I love you. We'll be back here on the Heart of the East End.